You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Inner Experiences of Evolution. Lecture 4 is entitled The Inner Aspect of the Moon Embodiment of the Earth, given in Berlin, November 21st, 1911. Footnote: this lecture, as will become evident, was given on the 100th anniversary of the death, by his own hand, of the great German dramatist, poet, and prose writer, the genius's genius, Heinrich von Kleist, 1777 to 1811. End of footnote. We have pursued a difficult aspect of our worldview to the point where, to some extent, we have learned to see the spiritual reality that lies behind appearances in the outer sensible world. Outwardly, however, appearances only very slightly betray the real fact that the characteristic form of the spiritual, as we experience it in our soul life, actually stands behind what we see in the sensible world. Yet we have come to recognize that spiritual activity, spiritual qualities and characteristics, do indeed stand behind such appearances. For example, we now recognize that what appears to us in ordinary life as the quality of warmth, heat, or fire is the spiritual expression of sacrifice. And in what we encounter as air, which in our concepts reveals so little that it is spiritual, we recognize what we call the bestowing virtue of particular cosmic beings. In water we recognize what can be called resignation, renunciation. In earlier worldviews, I mention this briefly, the existence of the spiritual within the outwardly material was, of course, more quickly intuited and recognized. Evidence of this may be seen in our habitual use today of the word spirit, which today we use in a particular way concerning what is spiritual, to refer to especially volatile substances. I say spiritual rather than spirit. In the outer world, however, people do not necessarily apply the term spiritual to true spiritual reality or what is beyond the senses. As some of you know, a letter was once addressed to a Munich society of spiritualists, and no one knew what a society of spiritualists was. So it was delivered to the main office of the merchants of spirits, that is, alcoholic beverages. To return to our theme, today we will look at the significant transition that occurred in the development of the planet Earth as evolution progressed from ancient sun to ancient moon. Thus, we will have to consider another kind of spiritual development. We must begin with the point we took up in the last lecture, the act of renunciation. We saw last time that in this renunciation or foregoing, spiritual beings give up the opportunity to receive a sacrifice that we recognized as the sacrifice of will or the will substance. When we imagine that certain beings wished to sacrifice their will substance, and that higher beings declined to accept this will by their act of foregoing, then we will easily rise to the concept that this will substance, which these beings wished to sacrifice to higher spiritual beings, had to remain with the beings who wished to sacrifice it, but were not allowed to do so. Thus, within the context of the cosmos, there are beings who were ready to present their sacrifice, that is, were prepared devoutly to surrender what reposes in their innermost being, but were not permitted to do so, and therefore had to keep it within themselves. Or to put it another way, because the sacrifice was rejected, these beings could not establish a certain bond with higher beings that would have come about had they been allowed to sacrifice. Cain's confrontation with Abel in the Bible personifies and historically symbolizes some of the meaning of this rejected sacrifice, albeit in an intensified way. Footnote: for other aspects of the deep significance of the story of Cain and Abel, see Rudolf Steiner titled The Temple Legend, and titled The Effects of Spiritual Development on the Human Sheaths. End of footnote. Cain also wanted to offer his sacrifice to his God, but his sacrifice was not found pleasing, and God would not accept it. Abel's sacrifice, on the other hand, was accepted by God. What we want to pay attention to here is Cain's inner experience when he discovered that his sacrifice was rejected. To reach the greatest possible degree of understanding in this matter, we must be clear that we should not introduce into the higher regions, of which we are speaking of here, ideas that have meaning only in ordinary life. It would be false to say that the rejection of the sacrifice came about through fault or wrongdoing. In these regions we cannot yet refer to sin and atonement as we are familiar with them in ordinary life. Rather, we have to view these beings from the perspective of the higher beings who refused the sacrifice. In other words, the higher beings were simply relinquishing or withdrawing their acceptance of the sacrifice. There is nothing that indicates any fault or failure in the mood of soul that we characterized last week. Rather, the act of surrender and resignation encompasses all that is great and meaningful. Yet we can sense that within those beings who wanted to offer the sacrifice, there did arise a mood that initiated something like opposition, even if it was extremely faint opposition, toward those beings who refused their sacrifice. Therefore, when this mood of opposition presents itself to us at a later time, as in the case of Cain, it is presented in a magnified manner. We will not find the same mood that we find in Cain also in those beings who developed during the transition from the sun to the moon. Among these beings, the mood of opposition occurs in a different degree. Again, we can come to know this mood in an authentic way only if we look into our own soul, as we did during the last lecture, and ask ourselves where we can find such a mood in our own soul, and what soul conditions can make us aware of the mood that must have developed in the individuals whose gift of sacrifice had been rejected. This mood in us, and here we come closer and closer to earthly human life, is actually familiar to every soul in its uncertainty, and at the same time in its torment or pain, in a way that I will address more fully in next Thursday's public lecture, quote, The Hidden Depths of Soul Life, unquote. This mood or attitude familiar to every soul reigns in the secret depths of soul life and presses toward its surface, where the mood, perhaps, creates the least torment. Footnote: lecture of November 23, 1911, in Menschengeschichte im Lichte des Geistesforschung, G.A. 61, untranslated. End of footnote. But we human beings often go around in this mood. Without being aware of it in our higher consciousness, we carry it within us. We may recall the words of the poet, "Only one who knows longing knows what I suffer." Footnote, line from Mignon's song in Goethe's Wilhelm Meister. End of footnote. These words capture the vague yet persistent torment of the soul that also carries a nuance of pain with it. What is meant here is longing as a mood of soul. This is longing as it lives continuously in the human soul, as a soul mood, and not just when the soul aspires to or strives for this or that. In order to transport ourselves into what occurred spiritually in the evolutionary phases of ancient Saturn and the Sun, we had to raise our gaze to special conditions of the soul that start to appear when the human soul begins to strive and orient itself toward a higher striving. In the second lecture, we tried to clarify the nature of surrender or sacrifice by drawing it out of our own soul life. We saw what a human being can achieve of the wisdom that we see trickling into and created out of what one could call the willingness to give, or the readiness to surrender one's own self. the closer we approach the earthly circumstances that have developed out of earlier conditions, the more we encounter a mood of soul that is similar to what human beings today can still experience. But we must be clear that our whole soul life, insofar as our soul is inserted into an earthly body, lies like a top layer over a hidden soul life that flows in depths beneath its surface. Who would fail to know that there is a hidden life of soul? Life teaches us well enough that such a soul life exists. In order to clarify something about this hidden life of the soul, let us assume that a child, let us say in the seventh or eighth year, or at another time of life, experiences this or that. For example, having been blamed for doing something, which in fact he or she did not do, a child may have experienced an injustice. Children are often especially sensitive to this. Nevertheless, it was convenient for those around the child to settle the matter by blaming the child for doing this or that. Children, indeed, are acutely sensitive to suffering and injustice in this way. But life is such that after this experience has eaten deeply into this young life, the following years added other layers to the soul's existence, and the child, at least in terms of everyday life, forgot the matter. Perhaps such a matter never again arises. But let us assume that at the age of 15 or 16, a young person, let us say at school, experiences a new injustice. And now what otherwise lay at rest, deep within the surging soul, begins to stir. The young person in question doesn't even need to know that a recollection of what he or she experienced in earlier years is at work, and may actually form completely different ideas and concepts. If what had occurred earlier had not taken place, however, then, for example, if it were a young man, he would simply go home, shed a few tears, and perhaps also complain a bit, but he would get over it. But since the earlier event did occur, here I emphasize very pointedly that the young person does not need to know what is happening. The earlier event works beneath the surface of the life of soul, just as beneath the smooth appearance of the ocean surface waves may be surging. And what otherwise would have resulted only in tears, complaints, and insults, now becomes a student's suicide. Thus, from the deepest levels, the hidden depths of the soul life rise to the surface to play their role. And the most important force that rules in these depths, becoming most significant as it presses upward in its original form, and about which we nevertheless remain unconscious, is longing. We know the names that this force has in the outer world, but these are only vague, metaphoric names, because they express relationships that are complex and do not at all rise into consciousness. Let us take a familiar phenomenon. Those who live in the city may be less affected by it, but even they, nonetheless, will have observed it in others. I mean the feeling one describes as homesickness. If you were to explore what homesickness really is, you would see that basically homesickness is something different for every human being. For one person, it is this, for another person, something else. One person longs for the familiar tales he or she listened to at home, never realizing that he or she is really yearning for home. What lives within the individual is an unfocused longing, an undirected wishing. Another longs for his or her mountain, or, when watching rippling water, for the river where he or she often used to play. All these different qualities that are often unconsciously at work in the soul may be included in the term homesickness, which expresses something that can be played out in thousands of different ways, and yet is best described as a kind of longing. Even more indefinite are the yearnings that arise as perhaps the most tormenting ones in life. The human being is not aware longing is involved, but nevertheless, that is what it is. But what is this longing? By bringing it into connection with the mood of the beings who wish to offer sacrifice, but had to renounce their sacrifice, we have suggested that it is a kind of will, and wherever we examine this longing, we can see that it is a type of will. But what kind of will is it? It is a will or intent that cannot be fulfilled, for if it could be satisfied, the longing would cease. It is a will that cannot be realized. That is how we must define longing. Thus we would have to characterize the mood of those beings whose sacrifice was rejected somewhat as follows. What we can perceive in the depths of our soul life as longing is what remains in us as an inheritance from those ancient times we are now speaking of. Just as we receive other qualities as legacies from other ancient stages of development, so we receive from the moon phase of evolution all forms of longing to be found in the depths of the soul, all forms of will that cannot be fulfilled, of will that is held in check. By turning back the sacrifice offered during this phase of development, beings with restrained, held-back wills were created. Because they had to restrain and keep this will within themselves, they were in a very special situation. And here again, if one wishes to feel and experience these matters, one must transpose them into one's own condition of soul, for mere thoughts will scarcely suffice to penetrate these conditions. A being who can sacrifice the will becomes in a certain sense united with the other being in relation to whom the sacrifice occurs. That too we can feel in human life, how we live and weave ourselves into a being to whom we bring a sacrifice, how fulfilled and happy we feel in the presence of that being. Here we are speaking of sacrifice to higher beings, encompassing universal beings, to whom the sacrificing beings glance upward in utter delight. And for this reason, what is held back by the beings as restrained will, as longing, can never be the same as it would have been in inner mood, in inner soul content, as it would have been had they been allowed to complete their sacrifice. For if the sacrificing beings had been permitted to make their sacrifice, it would have become part of the other beings. We may say then, by way of comparison, that if the earth and the other planetary beings had been allowed to sacrifice to the sun, then they would have been united with the sun. But if they were not permitted to sacrifice to the sun, and had to withhold what they would have sacrificed, then they would remain separate and draw their sacrifice back into themselves. If we grasp what is now expressed in a single word, then we notice that something new has entered into the cosmic all. Understand clearly that it cannot be expressed in any other way. Beings who would sacrifice to another all that lives within them, who would surrender themselves to a universal being, such beings, when the sacrifice is not accepted, are instructed to carry the sacrifice within themselves. Don't you feel that something flashes up here that we may call ego or egoity, which later emerges as egoism in all its forms? In this way we can feel that what flowed into evolution continued to live on as a legacy within those beings. Within longing, we see egoism flashing like lightning, albeit in its weakest form. And we also see longing slipping into cosmic development. And thus we see how beings who surrender to longing, that is, surrender themselves to their egoism, are, if something else does not intervene, condemned in a certain way to one-sidedness, to living merely in themselves. Let us imagine a being who has been permitted to sacrifice. This being lives in the other being, and forever lives in the other. A being who has not been permitted to sacrifice can live only within its own being. Thus, such a being is excluded from all that he or she would have experienced in the other being, in this instance, in higher beings. In this case, in fact, the beings in question would have been taken out of the course of evolution, condemned and banished to one-sidedness, had something not occurred that sought to enter the course of development to eliminate the one-sidedness. This something is the entry of new beings who prevent the condemnation and exile into one-sidedness. Just as, in the instance of the beings of will on Saturn and the beings of wisdom on the Sun, so on the Moon we see the spirits of movement step forth. By this we are not imagining movement in space. Rather, by the term movement, we refer to something that is more related to the process of thinking. Everyone knows the expression movement of thought, although this refers just to the flow and the fluidity of one's own thinking. But even from this expression we can see that if we wish to gain a comprehensive grasp of movement, we must understand that movement is something other than merely changing position in space. That is just one aspect of movement. If a number of human beings are devoted to a higher being who expresses all that is in them because the higher being accepted all that was offered in sacrifice, then these human beings live and are fulfilled in that one being. If their sacrifices are rejected, however, these human beings must live within themselves and can never be fulfilled. Thus the spirits of movement enter and lead the beings who would otherwise have had to depend upon themselves into relationship with all of the other beings. The spirits of movement must not be thought of as beings who just bring about changes in location. Rather, they are beings who bring forth something whereby one being continuously comes into new relation to others. We can form an idea of what is attained at this stage of the cosmos if we again reflect on the corresponding mood of soul. Who does not know what torment it is when longing comes to a halt, a standstill, and cannot experience change of any kind? It forces a person into the unbearable state we call boredom. But this boredom, which we usually attribute only to superficial people, has all manner of levels. This boredom even has levels that affect great and noble natures, in whom there lives what their own nature expresses as a longing that cannot be satisfied in the outer world. And what better way is there to satisfy this longing than through change? The evidence for this is that beings who feel this longing search continuously for relations with new beings. The anguish of the longing is often overcome through what is brought about by changed relations with constantly new sets of beings. Thus we see that while the earth went through its moon phase, the spirits of movement brought change, movement, and ever-renewing connections to new beings and situations into the lives of the yearning-filled beings who otherwise would have become desolate, for boredom is a kind of desolation. Movement in space from one place to another is only one aspect of this broad spectrum of movement of which we are speaking. We experience another kind of movement when, in the morning, we have a specific thought content in our soul, so that we do not have to keep to ourselves but can give to someone else. In this way we overcome one-sidedness in our longing through variety, change, and movement in what we experience. What we have in external space is just a special kind of capacity for change. Consider a planet facing the sun. If the planet were always in the same position in relationship to the sun, if it never moved, it would remain fixed in its one-sidedness. The planet would always turn just one side to the sun. But then, to bring about a change in its position, the spirits of movement come and lead the planet around the sun. A change in location is just one kind of change. And when the spirits of movement bring about change of location in the cosmos, they bring about a specific instance of the general phenomenon of movement. Because the spirits of movement have introduced movement and change into the cosmos, something else has to come with it. We have seen an evolution that is, in the whole cosmic multiplicity, evolving in the form of the spirits of movement, spirits of personality, spirits of wisdom, spirits of will, and so forth, that substantiality is also present in the form of the bestowing virtue that streams toward radiating wisdom to form the spiritual basis of air and gas. This now flows together with the will that has been transformed into longing, and in these beings becomes what human beings know, not yet as thought, but as picture. We can visualize this best with the image we have when dreaming. The fleeting, fluid dream picture can call forth an image of what occurs in a being in whom will lives as longing, and who is led into relation with other beings by the spirits of movement. As a being is brought before another, the first being cannot entirely surrender itself to the other. Let me read that again. As a being is brought before another, the first being cannot entirely surrender itself to the other, for its own egoity lives within it. But the being in question can receive a fleeting picture of the other being, a picture that lives like a dream picture within it. In this way, what we may call the rising tide of images in the soul arises. In other words, picture consciousness came into being during this phase of development. And since we, human beings ourselves, went through this phase of development without our current earthly I consciousness, we must imagine ourselves without what we attain today through our I. In that period, we existed and wove within the cosmic all, while something lived within us that we can compare with our experience of longing. In a certain way, if one forgot the conditions of suffering manifest on earth, one could imagine that suffering could not be other than the poet describes. Quote, "Only one who knows longing knows what I suffer." Unquote. It was during the moon phase that suffering and pain, as manifestations of the soul, came into our nature and into the nature of other beings who are bound up with our evolution. Thereafter, the otherwise empty inner self, the inner self that suffers from longing, was filled with a healing balm in the form of picture consciousness poured into these natures through the activity of the spirits of movement. If this had not happened, these moon beings, moon natures, would have been empty in their soul, empty of everything other than longing. But the balm of the pictures trickles in, fills the solitude and emptiness with manifoldness, and thus leads beings out of the state of exile and condemnation. When we take such words seriously, we have both what lies spiritually at the foundation of what developed during the moon phase of our earth, and what now lies layered beneath the earth phase in the deep recesses of our consciousness. But this lies so deep within the recesses of our soul, and I shall show this the day after tomorrow in a popular form, in a public lecture, that it can become active in these recesses without our being aware of it, and then emerge into consciousness, just as surging waters in the ocean's depths create waves on its surface. Beneath the surface of our ordinary eye consciousness, we have a deep-seated soul life that can surge to the surface. And what does this soul life say when it comes to the surface? Once we understand the cosmic foundation of this unconscious life of the soul, we can say that our soul life, which we can feel rising out of the recesses of the soul, is a breaking through of what was set in motion during the moon phase of development, but first penetrated us during the earth phase itself. And when we grasp the interplay of the moon nature with our earth nature, then we have the real explanation of what was brought over spiritually to earth existence from the ancient moon. Keep in mind, as I have just described, that it was necessary for pictures to surface continuously in order to alleviate the desolation. If you do so, then a concept of great import and significance will come to you, namely that the longing human soul, in its yearning, tormented emptiness, satisfies and keeps this longing in harmony through the constant succession of pictures arising one after the other. And after the images arise and remain a while, then the old longing dawns again in the recesses of the soul, and the spirits of movement call up new pictures. Then fresh images are present again for a while, until the longing for new pictures is once again renewed. The important statement we must make about this aspect of the life of the soul is that if the longing is satisfied only through images that in turn constantly seek out new images, then there is no end to this infinite flow. The only way to intervene in this process is if something enters the unending flow of images that can redeem the longing with something other than pictures, that is, with realities. In other words, the phase of the planetary embodiment of our Earth, in which images guided by the activity of the spirits of movement satisfy the longing, must be replaced by the planetary phase of the Earth embodiment that we must call the phase of redemption. Indeed, as we shall see, the Earth may be called the planet of redemption, just as the earlier embodiment of the Earth, moon existence, may be called the planet of longing, a longing that could be appeased, but only through a never-ending process stretching to infinity. Throughout this life, while we live in earthly consciousness, which, as we have seen, brings before us the act of redemption through the mystery of Golgotha, there arises out of the recesses of our soul that which continuously creates a longing for redemption. It is as if we had waves of ordinary consciousness at the surface of consciousness, and beneath this, in the depths of the ocean of our soul life, the bedrock of our soul lived in the form of a longing, and this longing aspired ceaselessly to carry out the sacrifice to the universal being who can satisfy it, not just appease it with an infinite sequence of pictures, but fulfill it once and for all. As earthly human beings, we can actually feel these moods. They are the best a person can experience. Indeed, those earthly human beings who today, in our time, above all, feel this longing are those who are coming toward our spiritual scientific movement. In external life, we learn to recognize everything that satisfies our ordinary surface consciousness. Out of our unconsciousness, however, there pulses something that can never be satisfied by external particulars and longs for the central foundation of life. But we can attain this central basis only once we have a universal science that concerns itself with the totality of life, not just with particulars. What arises in the depths of the soul today, seeking to be brought into higher consciousness, must be brought into contact with universal existence that lives in the world. If this contact is not made, then the longing for something unachievable arises out of the recesses of the soul. Spiritual science, in this sense, is a response to the longings that live in the recesses of the soul. And since everything that occurs in the world has its prelude in an earlier time, we should not be surprised that a person living today would want to subdue the power of the longing in his or her soul through spiritual science, especially when such soul forces lie beyond conscious awareness and threaten to consume a person, as these longings do. Had such a person lived earlier, when this spiritual wisdom did not exist and so was unobtainable, he or she would have wasted away with ever-present longing for spiritual wisdom and been denied the possibility of grasping the meaning of life. Precisely he or she was a great spirit. Today, on the other hand, something can trickle into the soul that would ease the longing for images and drown out and silence the desolation. Earlier, a person could only long for a cessation of this march of images and long for it all the more as the throng of images became increasingly persistent. When we hear Heinrich von Kleist writing to a friend in the following way, we can hear this expressed in the voice of someone who lived in an era when one could not yet attain this spiritual wisdom that pours itself out like balm into the longing of the soul. Long quote. Who desires to be happy on this earth? I would almost like to say, shame on you if you want to be happy. What short-sightedness it is, O noble human being, to strive for such a goal here, where all ends in death. We meet, we love each other for 3 springs, and then, for an eternity, flee from each other. And yet what is the striving worth when there is no love? Ah, there has to be something more than love, happiness, fame, and XYZ, something our souls do not even dream about. It cannot be an evil spirit who stands at the pinnacle of the world. It is just something incomprehensible. Don't we, too, smile when children cry? Just think of this unending vastness, myriad realms of time, each one a life, and each one a manifested existence such as this world of ours. What is the name of the little star we see when the heavens are clear and we gaze at Sirius? And this gigantic firmament is only a speck of dust in relation to infinity. O moment of stillness, tell me, is this a dream? Between 2 linden leaves, which we watch as we lie on our backs in the evening, lies a perspective richer in intuitions than our thoughts can grasp and words can express. Come, let us do something good and die doing so. One of the millions of deaths we have already died and must yet die in the future. It is as if we go from one room into another. Look, the world appears to me as if it were all boxed up together. The small is just like the great. End of quote, footnote, letter of August 31st, 1806. End of footnote. The longing expressed in these words drove this individuality to write to his friend in this way. But this spirit, Kleist, could not yet find a satisfaction for his longing in the way that modern souls can today when they approach spiritual science with energetic understanding. For this spirit is one who ended his life 100 years ago when he shot first his friend Henrietta Vogel and then himself, and who now rests on the banks of the Wannsee in the lonely grave that first enclosed his remains a century ago. Footnote, Heinrich von Kleist, 1777-1811. On November 21st at 4 p.m. in the Stimmings Inn in Potsdam, Kleist shot Henry de Vogel and then shot himself. On the morning of his death he wrote to his friend and cousin by marriage, Marie von Kleist, "My dear Marie, if you knew how death and love took turns crowning these last moments of my life with blossoms, those of heaven and those of earth, surely you would be willing to let me die. I assure you I am wholly joyous. Mornings and evenings I kneel down, something I can never do before, and I pray to God. For this is my life, the most tormented of any that anyone has ever lived. I can now at last thank Him, since He makes it good through the most glorious and sensual of deaths." End of footnote. It is a remarkable act of providence, one would like to say of karma, that we can speak here of what Kleist expresses, which best describes what we tried to say about the transformation of the withheld sacrifice of will into longing, the easing of which can occur through the spirits of movement and the impulse toward final satisfaction of longing, which may be attained on the planet of redemption. It is a remarkable karmic resolution that precisely on this day we speak about what reminds us of a soul who brought this unfocused longing to expression in the most elevated language, and then poured this yearning into the most tragic deed in which the longing can be embodied. How can we fail to recognize that this man's spirit in its totality, as he stands before us, is actually a living embodiment of what lives deep within the soul and leads us back to an existence other than an earthly existence, if only we want to recognize it. Does not Kleist describe for us in the most meaningful way what a person can experience of what impels human beings to seek what lies beyond them, which later he would have comprehended if he had not prematurely severed the thread of his own life? Did he not experience just what you may find described in the first pages of titled The Spiritual Guidance of the Individual and Humanity? Footnote by Steiner, end footnote. Think of von Kleist's Penthesilea. Footnote. Kleist wrote his ferocious tragedy, Penthesilea, based on the late Greek legend of the bloody battle between Achilles and Penthesilea, the queen of the Amazons, in 1806, offering it to Goethe on the knees of my heart. Kleist called it his most personal work. My innermost nature is contained in it. End of footnote. How much more there is in Penthesilea than she can fathom with her own earthly consciousness. Footnote. Joachim Maas, Kleist, a biography, page 142. Quote, Kleist, a psychological visionary of the first rank, possessed a knowledge which his contemporaries had no suspicion of, and which, when it was brought to their attention in Penthesilea, they did not understand. He had insights which today are the concern of depth psychology, and which have been expressed most uncannily by Rilke in his Duino Elegies. In a very strange way, Kleist had followed Rousseau back to nature, and with clairvoyant eye looked into the darkness of the human soul. But people of his time did not understand him. End quote, end footnote. We could not understand her in her particularity at all, if we could not presume that her soul is infinitely more expansive than the narrow little soul that she, a great soul, encompasses with her earthly consciousness. Therefore, in the play, a situation must arise that artistically draws the unconscious into the drama. Thus the possibility that the series of events, as Kleist sets them before Achilles, would be surveyed with higher consciousness must be prevented. Otherwise we would not be able to experience the magnitude of the tragedy. Penthesilea is led captive to Achilles, but she is deluded into believing that Achilles is her prisoner. That is why reference is made to her Achilles. What lives in the aware consciousness must be plunged into non-consciousness. And what role does this lower consciousness play in a situation like the one portrayed in title Katie of Heilbronn? Footnote, no sooner had Penthesilea seen the light of day than a counterfigure in Katie von Heilbronn, or The Ordeal by Fire, a great historical chivalry play, made her appearance. Ibid, page 134, end of footnote. Let me read that sentence again. And what role does this lower consciousness play in a situation like the one portrayed in Katie of Heilbronn, especially with respect to the remarkable relationship between Katie and Vetter of Stral, which is not carried out in full consciousness, but in the deeper levels of the soul, where powers reside that move from one person to another unbeknown to human beings? With this situation before us, we feel the spiritual nature of what lies within the ordinary forces of gravitation and attraction in the world. We feel what lies within the forces of the world. For example, in the scene where Katie stands facing her beloved, we see what lives beneath consciousness, and how it is related to what lives externally in the world, and to what one refers to dryly as the attracting powers of the planets. A century ago, not even a penetrating, striving soul could plunge into this deeper level of consciousness. Today it is possible to do so. The tragedy of the title Prince of Homburg also strikes us in a completely different way today than it did a century ago. Footnote, Kleist's last and greater play, written 1810, quote, a work that Nietzsche described as approaching closest among the moderns to that almost mythical idea, a rebirth of tragedy. From Miller, title An Abyss Deep Enough. End of footnote. I would like to know how an abstract thinker, who wishes to attribute everything a human being accomplishes to reason, would explain a figure like the Prince of Homburg, who carried out all of his great deeds in a kind of dream state, even those deeds that finally led to victory. Indeed, Kleist clearly shows that the prince could not have achieved his victory out of his aware consciousness, and that with regard to higher consciousness, he was not a particularly distinguished person, for afterward he whimpered in the face of death. Only when what lived deep within his soul was drawn out by an extraordinary effort of will, only then was the prince able to pull himself together. What remains as a legacy for the human being, out of the moon consciousness, is something that cannot be brought out by abstract science. It is something that must be derived from concepts that are many-sided, subtle, and capable of grasping spiritual matters with soft contours, that is, concepts such as are brought by spiritual science. The greatest concepts connect themselves to the intermediary and the ordinary ones. Thus we see that spiritual science shows how conditions we experience in our soul today are connected to the cosmos and cosmic totality. We also understand how only what we experience in the soul can generate a concept of the spiritual foundation of things. Furthermore, we begin to comprehend that in our age, it becomes possible to satisfy what the age preceding our own longed for, but which could only be given in our time. Thus a kind of admiration arises for those human beings in a previous age who could not find their way to what their hearts longed for. The world could not give it to them. Truly, when we remind ourselves that all human life is a whole, and that a person today can devote his or her life to spiritual movements that human beings long ago already had need of, as indeed their destinies show us, then a certain admiration for such individuals can arise. And so we may point to spiritual science as a bearer of the redemption of human longing. Above all, we may do so on a day that, since it is the centenary of the tragic death of one of these yearning individuals, is well suited to remind us that spiritual science now provides what tempestuous but also woeful human beings have sought for a long time. This is the thought, perhaps also the anthroposophical thought, that we can lay hold of on this 100th anniversary of the death of one of the greatest German poets. The end of Lecture 4.